for decades and some little pissant. He saw Charlie about to object, so he amended his statement. Some freshly appointed congressman whom you perceive to be a nuisance comes along and objects to millions of dollars you've procured for an American company that provides thousands of jobs in congressional districts all around the nation, Kefauver said. Right, I get that, Charlie said. Those jobs belong to voters, who are, of course, the ones who send us here, Kefauver said. They're our bosses. And surely our bosses would object to giving money to war profiteers who provided shoddy goods, risking and even costing the lives of our men, Charlie said. This is a fight I didn't seek, sir, but to be frank, I'm stunned that any of my colleagues in Congress would challenge me on it. Well, Charlie, I'm talking about the chairman of the committee and some others in leadership, and I'm quite certain they don't think of you as a colleague. But of course you should fight for what you think is right. That's an admirable trait, and too few of us possess it. Just know that this town isn't built to reward it. I'm starting to get that impression, Charlie said. Kefauver looked down at his glass. Charlie felt obliged to fill the slightly prickly silence. W.C. Fields, Charlie said, always carry a flagon of whiskey in case of snake bite, and, furthermore, always carry a small snake. Kefauver smiled. What else shall we drink to? To a real leader at the top of your party's ticket 2 years from now, Charlie said. Clink, clink. Kefauver downed the entire glass in one easy gulp. The door to the conference room opened without warning, and an older man walked in. His jowl sagged like a mastiff's. Behind him stood one of the senator's aides, who apparently had been trying to politely prevent the man from bursting in unannounced. Kefauver waved the aide off. "Why, hello, doctor," Kefauver said, standing and extending a hand. "Congressman Marta, may I present Dr. Frederick Wortham?" "It's very nice to meet you, sir," Charlie said, following Kefauver's lead and standing to shake the doctor's hand. "This is the young congressman I told you about, Frederick," Kefauver said. "His father and I are old friends." He motioned for both men to sit down. "Charlie, I assume you're acquainted with the groundbreaking psychiatric work Dr. Wortham has done at Bellevue, and his philanthropic work with the colored people of your home city. The Lafargue Clinic, did I pronounce the name correctly, doctor?" "We're in Harlem," Wortham said, ignoring the question. "I set up the clinic just after the war, a project with Richard Wright and some others. You know Wright, I assume?"
"The writer?" asked Charlie.
"Of course," snapped Wortham, as if it had been glaringly obvious that the only Richard Wright he might know would be the author of the acclaimed Native Son. "Well, it's not an uncommon name," Charlie couldn't help observing. "Anyway, I don't personally know him, but the book was haunting. Could have done without the stage adaptation." "On that we are in agreement," Wortham softened a bit. "In any case, Richard and I established a mental hygiene clinic for the good people of Harlem who are unable to afford psychiatric care, not only because of the unjust capitalist system that keeps them impoverished, but also because most psychiatric institutions do not admit Negroes." Wortham's face had turned pink, and his voice was rising. "How are we to solve the problem of crime in New York City without addressing the psychiatric needs of the very underclass committing the crimes?" He was only about 3 feet away from Charlie, close enough for Charlie to identify the smell on the gust of bad breath he exhaled. Tuna fish. There was an uncomfortable silence, one Charlie filled when he suddenly remembered the first time he'd heard Wortham's name. "Correct me if I'm wrong," Charlie said, "but weren't you part of the defense in Albert Fish's trial?" Albert Fish was a child molester, a murderer, and a cannibal. He had been executed in 1936 when Charlie was 16. "Yes, I testified in that trial," Wortham said to Charlie. "What a travesty. The jury did not care in the slightest that Mr. Fish had no control over himself. His illness was just as real as if he'd had a tumor rotting his brain. And yet they punished him for his disease. The 12 boors on that jury had bloodlust just as bad as Mr. Fish's, but their taste for flesh
was the kind that society deems socially acceptable.
My father was on the defense team, Charlie said. Winston Martyr?
Wortham looked at him blankly. Anyway, admirable work for the people of New York, Charlie said. How can I help? What can I do?
I'm glad you asked, said Kefauver. We're holding hearings on juvenile delinquency this spring, maybe April. Wortham is our key witness. The hearings will be in New York, in your congressional district, and we'd like you to help host and arrange a venue. We'd also like you to participate.
He glanced at Wortham.
Estes here feels we need some youth on the panel, Wortham said.
I'm 33, said Charlie. Hardly young.
For Congress, you're an infant, said Wortham. This place is practically a museum exhibit of sarcophagi.
These are going to be big, Charlie, said Kefauver. We're going to tear the lid off one of the most pernicious influences in our culture today.
There will be a lot of press coverage. It will be a stellar opportunity to establish yourself.
When folks hear you're part of my next project, my guess is they'll be more inclined to treat you with the respect you clearly feel you deserve.
And what are we going after? Charlie asked, ignoring the jibe. What exactly is the pernicious influence?
Wortham smiled. It was the moment he'd been waiting for.
Comic books, he said.
Chapter 5. Monday, January 18th, 1954. Maryland, Rural Route 32, and the U.S. Capitol.
Comic books? Asked Margaret.
So did you laugh in his face? Margaret was using the desk phone at Polly's Lodging, a motel about 5 miles from the Nanticoke Island campsite where she'd been conducting her research for the last 2 days. She'd volunteered to drive back to the mainland to buy some batteries and bread for the group, and she'd seized the opportunity to phone Charlie at work. She'd asked the long-distance operator to call back after their conversation was done and tell her the charges so she could give that amount to the motel owner, a dour older woman, presumably Polly.
You should have seen their faces, said Charlie.
He was sitting behind the desk in his congressional office staring at a framed photograph of Margaret from their wedding day, one that captured her laughing uproariously, her head thrown back. He reached for a cigarette.
It was as if they were revealing that milk causes cancer, but it was about goddamn Batman.
Charlie looked out his office window. Being the most junior member of the 83rd Congress, he had a view of the air conditioning unit of the second most junior member. Right after the meeting, Kefauver couriered over a package. Wortham has a book coming out in a few months. What's it called? He leafed through the manila folder. Seduction of the Innocent.
Sounds very dangerous, she said. Innocent people shouldn't be seduced.
This is no joke, Margaret,
Charlie protested in mock horror. Kefauver sent me an issue of Ladies' Home Journal from last November. On the front of the magazine,
What Parents Don't Know About Comic Books.
He paused to read dramatically.
Here is the startling truth about the 90 million comic books America's children read each month.
He argues that comic books are literally instruction manuals for children to become hardened criminals.
It sounds kind of silly, Margaret said.
Yes, and Kefauver wants to hold goddamn hearings on this in Manhattan in April.
Margaret paused, and Charlie had a feeling he knew why. She probably didn't care to hear him discuss doing something he didn't want to do, something he thought was an idiotic distraction. Their lives until now had been refreshingly free of any need for compromise. They were academics, idealists who'd participated in fundraisers to fight polio and to foster better education for poor children. For the first time, they were facing choices they didn't like.
More important, she finally said, how's the Goodstone fight?
Nothing since we last spoke, really. Kefauver cautioned me to be careful. Miss Leopold is against my doing it. I'm going to a poker game for veterans in Congress tonight. I'll see if I can get them on board.
Sounds like a plan, she said.
So how are the ponies?
They're grand, said Margaret. About an hour after we arrived on Nanticoke, we saw some of the ponies literally frolicking in the surf.
So one research team's on Nanticoke and the other's on Susquehannock?
Yes. I'm with Lewis and one of his research assistants from Wisconsin.
And, he said, hesitating, when will I get to see you again?
Probably Saturday. It's so nice being back in the field, and if this is my last project for a while because of the baby, I don't want to leave too soon.
Sounds like wild horses couldn't drag you away, he muttered.
Ugh, awful, she chided him. You know, you shouldn't make bad dad puns until you actually become a dad.
But you won't really need to return to the field after the baby, Charlie said. If you want to make this book project a reality, you can work from home, right?
Sure, said Margaret. And I suppose we could set up a situation where I just squeeze out baby after baby between edits. Maybe one per project?
He was rapidly coming to understand that there was nothing that he could say on this topic that didn't sound selfish or, alternatively, insincere. So, not for the last time, Charlie didn't say anything in response. He chuckled and tried to change the subject, and the momentum of their phone call quickly petered out. Just after 7 that evening, Charlie knocked on Strongfellow's congressional office door. No one answered, but the door was unlocked, so he went in. Through the smog of cigar smoke, he saw a glorious view of the Capitol out the window. 20 members of Congress were standing around and sitting at tables in Strongfellow's reception area and conference room. Strongfellow swung around on his crutches, greeted Charlie, and shook his hand. "Thanks for coming, Charlie," he said, his boyishness offset by the gravity of his war wounds. "Thanks for the invitation," Charlie answered, looking around the room. "We started this during freshman orientation back in November 52. We called it dog face poker because it was just me and 3 infantry guys, just a way to blow off a little steam. But then it kept going, and Cav and the Navy and Air Force and others joined, and they didn't care for the name. Because we don't have hideous dog faces like you goddamn blister feet." This from a handsome dark-haired man seated nearby. Charlie recognized him as Congressman Pat Sutton from Tennessee, a Navy man and a Democrat. Strongfellow laughed. "Anyway, it took on a life of its own. Bipartisan, just vets. Everyone here fought in the war, so we know how doggone meaningless most of this Capitol Hill ta-ra-ra-boom-dee-ay is. It's a good place to unwind. The only rule is that nothing leaves here unless it's supposed to." "And just so you know," Sutton said, "this is only for real fighters. No jags, no cushy office jobs and personnel. If you were in the Air Force and you're here, you weren't a fucking penguin, you flew. Guns in hand, mud on boots." Charlie wondered if the remark had been a veiled reference to Senator McCarthy's supposedly exaggerated war record. Sutton shifted around in his seat to shake Charlie's hand. "Offer him some bourbon, you Mormon bastard," he said to Strongfellow, before turning back to the game and examining his cards. "I hear Kefauver's taking you under his wing," Sutton said to Charlie. "I raise 50 cents. "He's been very kind," Charlie said. "Pat's taking him on in the primary," said Strongfellow.
"Looks like Estes is going to get beat anyhow, so I might as well be the man to do it," Sutton said.
Charlie looked at Strongfellow, who seemed happy and in his element, surrounded by fellow veterans. He recalled reading Strongfellow's widely publicized story, part of the clandestine Military Intelligence Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. Strongfellow, a former Mormon missionary, had parachuted into Germany during the war to rescue an atomic physicist and bring him to Allied territory so he could be whisked to Los Alamos, New Mexico, to work with the team building the first atomic bomb. But one of his contacts was a double agent, and after a furious gun battle in which Strongfellow was gravely wounded, he was taken to the Belsen prison at Bergen-Belsen concentration camp. One night during his imprisonment, Strongfellow experienced a religious epiphany. God was with him and would guide him out of the prison. Amazingly, whether through divine providence or dumb luck, Strongfellow did manage to escape and make it to safety. After he recuperated and returned to Utah, members of The Church of Jesus Christ, Latter-day Saints found his tale so compelling
they took him around the state to preach the power of faith. His congressional election victory in 1952 followed easily soon after. "I don't drink, Charlie, but Sutton brought a bottle of what I'm told is some stellar Tennessee whiskey," Strongfellow said, gesturing toward a half-full jug sitting on his receptionist's desk. "We're starting a new game over here," he added, pointing at the couch, where another congressman was shuffling cards. Charlie poured himself a drink and took a seat on the couch as Strongfellow grabbed a chair. The other congressman introduced himself as Chris Mack McLachlan of Indiana. In his 50s, steely-eyed, balding with bushy eyebrows and an expanding waist, McLachlan was a Lutheran minister. "Army?" McLachlan asked Charlie. "First Battalion, 175th Infantry," Charlie said. "Mack was also in D-Day," Strongfellow said. 101st Airborne. "Second Battalion, 506th Parachute Infantry under Colonel Sink," McLachlan said, as he unpinned his cufflinks and rolled up his sleeves. "Drop Zone C, between Hinesville and St. Marie Dumont." "We landed at Omaha," said Charlie, loosening his tie. "I was in K Company. We secured the bridge over the Veer River and protected the right flank." McLachlan raised his glass and waited for Charlie's to greet it. "To those still there," McLachlan said. Clink. McLachlan dealt. Charlie waited until all five cards hit the coffee table before he picked up his hand. The cards were unusually thick. He studied the Queen of Spades. "Is this a map deck?" Charlie asked. McLachlan and Strongfellow both beamed. During the war, American and British intelligence agencies had worked with a playing card company to manufacture a special deck of cards that hid within them maps of escape routes on German territory near POW camps. Cards could be peeled apart to produce the maps, so they were ever so slightly thicker than average.
"You bet," said McLachlan.
"I got one from the OSS before I dropped into Germany," said Strongfellow. Charlie held a card up to the light, then examined its ridge. "One of the cards has been opened if you want to see." Strongfellow reached into the deck box and slid out a joker. He handed it to Charlie, who peeled it open, to reveal an escape route through the German village of Dalgo du Beretz. "Mac loves puzzles and hidden clues and such." Charlie whistled. "Amazing." "I had to soak it first," said Strongfellow.
"Ante up," said McLachlan. "Nickels in."
Charlie reached into his pocket, withdrew a dozen or so coins, and dropped them on the table. He steered a nickel into the pot.
"Speaking of anteing up, that was quite a move you made in appropriations," McLachlan said. "Not sitting out any hands, I see."
He smiled. As much as he hated to relive the event that had led him to speak up at the previous week's meeting, Charlie knew that this was his moment. Looking at his cards, he began. 10 days after we landed on Omaha Beach on June 17th, our orders were to seize Isigny, the bridge over the Veer River, then recapture Saint-Lô, La Madeleine, Pont-Renard, La Harris-Nessery, on and on. Basically nonstop combat until we met up with the Soviets at the Elbe. The two men were listening intently as Charlie paused to sip his drink.
"Cards?" McLachlan asked.
Charlie looked at his hand and threw down the two he didn't want. McLachlan tossed replacements in front of him. An 8 of hearts and a 9 of spades. A straight, almost a straight flush. McLachlan gave Strongfellow 3 cards and gave 1 to himself. They assessed their hands as Charlie continued. "So we're in the midst of recapturing Limon. We had easy company with us, too. There were Jerrys everywhere and Vichy French. It was a mess. You could hardly tell who was on whose side."
"Open with a dime," said McLachlan.
Charlie moved a dime from his pile to the center of the table. "I see you," he said. "See you in Ray's," Strongfellow said, putting 15 cents into the pot. He slid a cigar from his inside suit jacket pocket and began lighting it, swirling the cigar, sucking in, and waving the lighter beneath it. Charlie was momentarily confused, since he'd thought Mormons didn't smoke, but he let it pass. None of his business. "We were in a farmhouse outside of town, me and my platoon," Charlie continued. "Mortars were going off in the distance, but nothing near us. This French family was being friendly. Mom, Dad, 4 kids, a grandma. We were just talking, trying to communicate. None of us spoke French. Trying to figure out which Germans were around. And suddenly the older son, maybe 16, took out a knife and tried to stab me. He was scared sloppy and the blade hit my helmet, which I was holding. Strongfellow leaned back on the couch. McLachlan took a sip from his glass. So we restrained the kid and got concerned that something was going on, you know? We looked around the house, found nothing, then told the dad to show us the barn. He was nervous. He insisted on taking two of his kids with him, a boy and a girl, young, under 10. I guess his thinking was that if they were with him, we'd be less inclined to kill him. It was me, Rodriguez, Hillman. Charlie could name all his men in his sleep, but he realized it didn't much matter to the other congressmen. Anyway, most of my platoon went with me, and a couple stayed back in the house. He vividly recalled the faces of the men in his platoon. A motley gang of teenagers and guys in their 30s, some educated and others street smart. So we're in the barn, Charlie went on. And Rodriguez, the skinny private first class from Spanish Harlem, he notices some crates in a stall. They don't look like they belong there, so he goes to check it out, and right at that moment, a mortar explodes outside. Parts of the barn are blown away. A support beam falls right on top of the French family, and some sort of gas starts seeping out of one of the crates.
Gas? Said Strongfellow. Krauts didn't use gas.
Not on soldiers, they didn't, McLachlan corrected. Jews were another story.
I don't know that it was German gas. It might have been left over from the First World War. Who knows where it came from? Anyway, Hillman, our platoon sergeant, shouted for us to put on our gas masks, so we all fastened these cheap rubber things around our heads. Mortars are still going off outside the barn, so no one runs out, but we all sprint to the other end of the barn, except the family and Rodriguez. Rodriguez is pinned down under the beam, too, and he can't even reach his mask. Hillman had always thought the masks were pieces of garbage, so when he looked at me through the cheap plastic, I knew what he was thinking. I was the captain, though, and we had a man in trouble. I grabbed Corporal Miller's mask, told the platoon sergeant to follow me, and we ran to Rodriguez. I put the mask over Rodriguez's face while Hillman tried to move the beam off Rodriguez and the French family. More of my guys came over with their masks on, and they all tried to move the beam, but then they started choking with the masks on. Rodriguez, too, was choking, with his mask on. The French kids and the dad were choking without masks.
What about you? McLachlan asked.
Mine worked, Charlie said, wincing slightly. He took a sip from his glass and looked down, as if there were answers in the ice cubes. And then? Strongfellow asked, after the pause grew uncomfortable. Charlie exhaled dramatically, as if he were exhausted. The platoon sergeant and the other guys ran outside, vomiting. Their masks were worthless. If they'd stayed to save Rodriguez and the family, they would have died. The mortar started moving north. Somehow I managed to push the beam enough to wedge Rodriguez out and get him outside in the fresh air, but he was in bad shape, foaming at the mouth, eyes crossed, skin turning green.
What was it? Strongfellow asked. Mustard?
Don't know, Charlie said. We left the barn at once. Rodriguez was messed up. We had a few of the guys take him to an aid station a couple miles back, toward the beach. He died before he got there, we later were told. My other two men also got wounded in the process, shot. They survived, but we never saw them again either. Haber, Scully, shipped back home. Whole thing was FUBAR. There was a pause as Strongfellow and McLachlan collected their thoughts.
The French family? McLachlan finally asked. The dad and his two kids?
Charlie shook his head.
So this is why you want to block Goodstone, McLachlan continued. They made the gas masks.
They did, sir, Charlie said.
Did you report it? McLachlan asked.
Yes, sir, Charlie said. To my CO, and then later with paperwork related to Rodriguez's death.
Did they ever own up to it? Asked McLachlan. Issue any sort of report explaining what happened? And why it will never happen again? Compensate the Rodriguez family?
You know, I wonder that as well, Charlie said. After the markup, I had an aide look into it. Best I can tell, Goodstone did nothing, though the Army did tell me they notified the company.
Good Lord, McLachlan said, shaking his head. Wish I could say I was surprised.
You gonna keep pushing it? Strongfellow asked. Carlin seemed pretty PO'd. Before they could continue the conversation, there was a knock at the door, and a black man in his 30s wearing a gray flannel suit poked his head into the room.
"Is this the card game?" he asked.
There was an uncomfortable silence as the room full of white veterans decided what to do. Washington, D.C., like much of the nation, remained segregated in almost every way.
"You sure you're in the right place?"
one of the congressmen in the back of the room asked.
"This is the card game for veterans, unless I am mistaken," the man said. He thrust a hand into his baggy trouser pocket, then slowly began to extricate it. He raised his hand. Between his fingers dangled a blue and white striped ribbon, with one strip of red in the middle. Attached to the ribbon swung a small bronze replica of a propeller laid upon a cross pâté. A distinguished flying cross. Charlie realized the man with the medal was Isaiah Street, a former Tuskegee Airman, one of the elite flying aces in segregated units of the U.S. Army Air Forces, and a particularly decorated one at that. He and Representative Adam Clayton Powell, Jr. of New York were the only black men in Congress.
"I got a Purple Heart, too, in my other jacket," Street said,
"but all I did to earn that one was not die."
"We need a fourth over here, Congressman," Charlie said, glancing at Strongfellow and McLachlan, who nodded to affirm the invitation. The rest of the room turned back to their card games.
"Thank you, gentlemen," Street said, taking off his jacket as the other three finished up their hand. McLachlan won with a full house.
"My deal," said Strongfellow. "Texas Hold'em okay?"
"Only if we stick with cash," Charlie said.
"I can't call if Street throws down his distinguished flying cross."
Street laughed. "I like to get in the door on the first try," he said.
Strongfellow dealt each man two cards and placed three other shared cards face up on the table. The men fell into a brief silence, each contemplating his pair.
"Check," said McLachlan, and then he glanced at Charlie with one bushy eyebrow raised. "I hear you've been shanghaied by Kefauver to sign up for his latest publicity tour."
"What's he up to now?" asked Street.
"Check."
"Check," said Charlie.
"Check," said Strongfellow. He threw down a fourth shared card in the middle of the table.
"Nickel in," said McLachlan, throwing a coin into the pot.
"Oh, he's cooked up a bullshit hearing about comic books being the reason for urban crime waves," McLachlan said. "Kefauver's latest attempt to cast himself as a white knight in preparation for 56.
After Street anteed up, Charlie came to terms with the fact that he was holding a garbage hand.
"I'm out," he said.
"Raise," said Strongfellow, tossing a dime into the pot.
He slid the fifth and final shared card face up, prompting a harumph from McLachlan.
"Fold," he said.
"Sounds like the old okey-doke to me," Street said.
"Raise." He put down a quarter, and Strongfellow groaned mildly and tossed his cards on the table. Street reassembled the deck and began shuffling.
"Okey-doke?" asked Strongfellow.
"You'll forgive him, Street. He's from Utah," Charlie joked.
"A distraction," explained Street. "Omaha Hilo, gentlemen," he announced as he dealt the cards. "Okey-doke's a scam. The guy on the street who holds up his hat with one hand and says, 'Look at my hat, nothing in my hat,' and with the other hand, he's pinching your wallet."
"I don't think it's a distraction," said Charlie. "I think they mean it, and I'm in no position to say no."
"Course not," said McLachlan.
As Street finished dealing each man four cards face down, Charlie wondered how much he could press his case with his new friends. He inspected his cards, the ace of hearts, the ace of spades, the two of clubs, the seven of diamonds. Two aces before even one flop card had been dealt. A great start, but he couldn't seem too eager. He threw down a nickel.
"I need Kefauver on my side because of the cruddy gas masks I told you about," Charlie said as everyone else anteed up. "I don't think Goodstone should get another nickel from the taxpayers, and I could use any support, whether it's from Kefauver, someone else on the Subcommittee on Juvenile Delinquency, or any of you fine gentlemen."
Charlie turned to a confused-looking Street to offer a brief synopsis of the saga of the gas masks and Private First Class Rodriguez. Strongfellow chimed in with the more pressing issue of Chairman Carlin's anger at Charlie for trying to block federal funds from Goodstone.
"I know the answer before I ask," said Street,
But I assume Goodstone never reached out to the private's family?
Charlie shook his head. His two priorities upon returning to Manhattan after the war had been marrying Margaret and sitting down with the Rodriguezes to tell them what had happened. He saw them every June at St. Cecilia's in Manhattan, where they all lit candles. Near as I can tell, Goodstone's done everything they can to pretend it didn't happen.
Pretty crummy, Street said. Brother Powell's on appropriations. I can talk to him, see what he thinks.
I'd keep it quiet for now, boys, Strongfellow cautioned. Carlin is a mercenary.
But don't you think if we can get a sizable group of veterans in the house to oppose this, Carlin will see the writing on the wall? Charlie asked. Why would this be worth making a stink about? I doubt Goodstone would want the publicity.
This isn't some Andy Hardy movie, Charlie, McLachlan said. Folks don't band together when the chips are down and put on a show.
Mac is right, Street said. We need to learn a lot more before we do anything. We don't know if Goodstone has connections or a loose wallet or powerful friends or what.
You don't want to get in over your head, Strongfellow warned.
They had to have paid someone off to have gotten away with it, said Street.
Or some ones, agreed McLachlan.
I get it, said Charlie, now a bit embarrassed.
One just needs to be a bit more stealthy on this battlefield, Charlie, McLachlan said. And we need to do a lot more recon.
Carlin is mean, said Strongfellow. You can't just take him on willy-nilly.
But you're actually ahead of the game here in one way, said McLachlan. It makes more sense for you to try to get Kefauver to remove the Goodstone money when the bill gets to the Senate.
Here's the flop, said Street, throwing down the first shared card for the table, the Ace of Clubs. Charlie didn't believe in omens, but having two aces in the hole and a third on the table improved his mood a touch. Still, he felt naive and dejected, and couldn't help reflecting that principles had been a lot easier to fight for before he entered a world where there were actual consequences.
Chapter 6. Sunday, December 7th, 1941. New York City, New York. Charles Everett Martyr had been born prematurely in Manhattan on December 7th, 1920, a date of little consequence in any way until the day he turned 21. A birthday celebration lunch was planned around his schedule, and at 2 o'clock he met his parents at P.J. Clark's on 55th and 3rd. It was their favorite restaurant, unassuming and lively, and Mary Martyr pretended not to know that its chief attraction for her husband and son was the barroom radio, always tuned to whatever game was being played that day. As the Martyrs walked in, the Brooklyn Dodgers football team, which outer borough-born Winston rooted for, had won the coin toss in its game against Manhattan's New York Giants, a favorite of Charlie's, at the Polo Grounds. The family eased into a back booth as a waiter materialized, pen poised.
"Hamburger, please, medium rare with extra fries and a black-and-white shake," Charlie said.
"Starving," he explained to his mother when she looked shocked at his abrupt order.
"I was about to ask how it could be possible that my baby is officially an adult, but you still order like a 9-year-old, Mary Martyr teased.
"Martini for me, dry as a desert," put in Winston. "I want to see tumbleweeds skimming across the meniscus. Oh, and get one for my boy, too. 86 is milkshake, unless you plan on bringing it in a bottle with a nipple."
Mary did her best to ignore her husband's crudities, as did Charlie, who began to tell his parents about his upcoming exams, while he and his father pretended they weren't also listening to the football game blaring on the radio behind the bar. Mary had just asked Charlie about his plans, or lack thereof, after graduation in June, when Winston shushed them so he could hear more of the important bulletin interrupting the game.
"Flash, Washington," barked the broadcaster. "The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor."
As the waiter delivered the martinis, the restaurant fell into silence, except for a man's tinny, scratchy voice on the radio.
"Hello, NBC. Hello, NBC. This is KTU in Honolulu, Hawaii. I am speaking from the roof of the Advertiser Publishing Company building. We have witnessed this morning the distant view of a brief full battle of Pearl Harbor and the severe bombing of Pearl Harbor by enemy planes, undoubtedly Japanese. The city of Honolulu has also been attacked and considerable damage done."
Gasps throughout the restaurant,
Waiters stood frozen in place. Diners stared at one another in disbelief.
"This battle has been going on for nearly 3 hours," the man continued. "One of the bombs dropped within 50 feet of KTU Tower. It is no joke. It is a real war."
Mary Martyr looked at her husband gravely and then at her son. Her eyes welled up and she reached across the table to grasp Charlie's hand tightly. Winston pulled out his wallet and threw bills blindly on the table. Then he pulled Mary to her feet and shepherded his reeling family outside. In their brownstone on the Upper East Side, Winston, Mary, and Charlie spent the rest of that Sunday the same way millions of Americans did, huddled around their radio, terrified that Japanese planes would soon be attacking the U.S. mainland. Charlie became filled with an emotion other than fear. He was furious. A sneak attack on Honolulu by the Japanese. He could think of nothing more cowardly. The moment had been inevitable. Anyone with basic cognitive skills had been able to see for months that sooner or later the United States was going to have to make a choice about whether it was going to enter the war or allow the fascists to seize Europe. Charlie had long ago concluded that the United States needed to do the former. He had listened to all of Edward R. Murrow's broadcasts about the Nazi bombing of London the previous year, in September 1940. Since then, the Germans had started attacking American ships in the Atlantic Ocean. A U-boat had torpedoed the USS Kearney in October, killing 11 Navy men. President Roosevelt had begun painting a dire picture of what the Western Hemisphere would look like under Nazi control. In a speech just a few weeks before Charlie's birthday, the president had claimed that he'd obtained a secret map made by the Nazis showing how after they seized Europe, they intended to carve up Central and South America into 5 vassal states. Message? They're headed to our hemisphere next. Neither Charlie nor his parents were fans of FDR, but that speech had affected him. The president had acknowledged how difficult it was for Americans to grasp what the Nazis were doing. Quote, "To adjust ourselves to the shocking realities of a world in which the principles of common humanity and common decency are being mowed down by the firing squads of the Gestapo," unquote. FDR added that some critics thought perhaps the American people had grown so, quote, "fat and flabby and lazy, they would be now no match for the regimented masses who have been trained in the Spartan ways of ruthless brutality." But nothing could be further from the truth, he'd said, as if anticipating the Pearl Harbor attack. Quote, "We Americans have cleared our decks and taken our battle stations. We stand ready in the defense of our nation and the faith of our fathers to do what God has given us the power to see as our full duty." "Our duty," Charlie recalled, "and our homeland is now directly under attack." His father was studying his face.
"Don't get any ideas, Charlie," Winston said.
The news got worse throughout the day. Wave after wave of Japanese aircraft had killed at least 400 Americans. Though accurate numbers were difficult to come by, it was possible that thousands had been killed. The governor of Hawaii revealed that it hadn't just been sailors killed. Civilians in Honolulu had been slaughtered as well. Unconfirmed reports suggested that the U.S. battleships Oklahoma and West Virginia had been sunk, along with up to 7 U.S. destroyers. More than 300 American airplanes were believed to have been obliterated. Later that night, after Mary had fallen asleep on the couch, Winston turned off the radio and guided his son into his study, where he poured 18-year-old scotch into 2 glasses. A single lamp illuminated the wood-paneled room, which was packed with books of law and history, and held 1 small locked file cabinet where he kept papers too important to leave at his downtown office. Winston eased his bulky frame into his favorite leather chair and motioned Charlie to the sofa. They sat silently for a few minutes, the only sound a muted tick from the nearby desk clock. Charlie looked at his dad, a big bear of a man whose hair was beginning to thin up top. Winston looked at his son, his only child, the person he knew best in the world.
"You have to graduate in May," his father said.
"Tomorrow I'm going to register with Selective Service," Charlie responded. "It's the law. I'm 21.
"I know that," said Winston.
The lamp sat to his left, silhouetting his face.
"We anticipated this day. Your mother will push you to go to divinity school to escape the draft."
"Divinity school?" Charlie laughed.
"Yes, divinity students get deferments," Winston said.
Of course, she already asked me to look into getting you a job at the draft board. Another way to avoid shipping out. Charlie was about to protest, but he decided to hold back and hear what else his father had to say. His mother was always after him for rushing in speech, and not allowing conversation to breathe, not letting decisions and realizations happen naturally.
I'm not going to do that, Winston finally said.
I'm not going to shirk this. I have a duty. I'm enlisting.
I know, said his dad, but let's do this wisely.
I don't want a desk job at the Pentagon, Charlie said. I want to do my part, just like everyone else has to, just like all the kids in the Brooklyn neighborhood where you grew up. My life is worth no more than theirs. His father looked at him gravely. Charlie didn't know much about his dad's time overseas after being drafted to fight the Germans in 1918, just that he had been there, and he didn't talk about it.
The Battle of the Argonne Forest.
His voice trailed off, and he stared at the floor. He scratched his cheek with his right forefinger. Charlie held his breath.
This was before the Battle of Montfaucon, before Corporal York caught all those krauts. It was a bad time. The 35th Division got shredded.
He took a sip of his drink.
I can't even begin to describe how awful it was, he said. I would never wish it on you. If someone tried to draft you into it, I would do everything I could to prevent it.
I know, Dad, but I don't think I have a choice here. They attacked us. His father stood and walked over to the small fireplace. The housekeeper had already prepared the kindling, so all Winston needed to do was light a match. But the box, perched near a small stack of wood, was empty.
Damn, he said.
Charlie got up and handed his father his Zippo lighter. Winston struck the spark wheel 6 times before a flame appeared.
Should have got you a new lighter for your 21st, he said with a small smile. Birthdays seem sort of stupid right now, don't they?
He ignited the rolled-up newspapers tucked under the stack of wood in the fireplace. The kindling began to crackle. Charlie leaned his elbows on his knees and stared absently at the flames as they grew higher, until at last his father broke the silence.
Charlie, his father said, you need to finish school. Graduate. After that, I know you might enlist. I'll pull whatever strings you want for you to fight the Axis scum in whatever way you think best.
Charlie shook his head. I don't want special treatment.
You're not just any guy off the street in Brooklyn, his father said. You're smarter, and you're softer. We've been protecting you.
Softer? Charlie asked. Dad, I'm not—
Please, Charlie. I know exactly who you are, Winston Martyr said. Maybe softer isn't the right word, but you're good. And even more than that, you believe in goodness.
You don't?
No, I don't,
Winston said bluntly, and then he gave his son a tender smile.
It's funny. You and I are motivated by diametrically opposed views of human nature, but we agree on the need to kill as many Nazis and Japs as possible.
They sat in silence, the fire warming but not comforting them.
You may prove to be a great soldier, Winston Martyr said. Not because you're tough, because you're smart. But sacrifices are made in the field of battle, Charlie. Sacrifices will have to be made.
It was just about 3 weeks later, on December 27th, the day after Prime Minister Winston Churchill's address to a joint session of Congress, that Charlie met Margaret. Seeking refuge from all the war news, he was spelunking deep in the stacks of Columbia University's Butler Library on West 114th Street in Manhattan. What had started as an effort to research a term paper had become characteristically a form of free association scholarship, wherein the hunt for one book became the discovery of another, leading to a fascinating trove of rare manuscripts and oddities having nothing to do with the original project. Margaret Elizabeth Ann McDowell was a freshman at Barnard, routinely referred to by her roommate as a grind in the body of a cover girl. That night, in addition to preparing for calculus and biology exams, she was looking for a container of maps and notebooks from the estate of Benjamin Carroll, a Revolutionary War-era member of the Maryland elite, whose family had claimed the isthmus near Susquehannock and Nanticoke Islands. She hoped they might mention the ponies on the islands, Margaret's lifelong obsession, and the topic of a term paper she was writing for zoology. It was the Saturday night before New Year's Eve. Most Columbia and Barnard students had fled campus for the winter break,
and the library was exactly as Margaret preferred it, empty and hushed. Balancing four heavy textbooks, she staggered into her favorite spot, a quiet nook tucked under the staircase from the fourth to the fifth floors that nobody else seemed to have discovered. Tonight, however, she was unhappy to turn the corner and see her usual desk occupied. A young man wearing white cotton gloves was peering closely at a book so old and fragile it looked as though a sneeze might cause it to explode into dust. Her foot squeaked on the floor, and he looked up sharply. Caught in mutual surprise, Margaret and the interloper considered each other. He was broad-shouldered and bookish, not an uncommon breed on campus. The window rattled as the wind outside the library howled. The heater next to Charlie's table began to clank and hum. "Hello," she said finally. He seemed to shake himself out of a mild stupor and smiled. "Hello yourself." He motioned, somewhat possessively, she thought, toward the official sign on the wall. "What brings you here to Colonial Manuscripts and Letters Archives, recent acquisitions?" Margaret shifted her arms to alleviate the strain of the book she was carrying. "I imagine the same thing as you? Research? Homework?" She was accustomed to the men she met on campus, assuming her studies were a token effort in her pursuit of an MRS degree. But Charlie actually blushed, something she was less accustomed to seeing. "Sorry, I meant, what are you studying?" Margaret softened a bit and deposited her books on the unoccupied corner of the desk with a small sigh of relief. She shook out her arms and began to unwind her heavy scarf. Charlie pulled out the other chair for her, and she resisted informing him that he was playing host in a place she considered her own. "These books are for exams, but I'm also here looking for some recent acquisitions having to do with these wild ponies in Maryland. No one knows where they came from," she explained. "You're a history major?" "Zoology," she said. "There are these new journals the library obtained from the colonial era from rural Maryland, from the estate of the Carroll family. Kind of a crapshoot, but I wanted to see if there was any mention of the ponies from around that time."
"Fascinating," Charlie said.
"Yes, they're an amazing string," she said.
"String?"
"That's what you call a group of ponies," she said. "Like a pride of lions, or a flock of geese."
"Or a murder of crows."
"Precisely," she said. "Or a congregation of alligators, or an obstinacy of buffalo, a crash of rhinoceroses, a gaze of raccoons."
She was showing off, but she enjoyed it. "I think you've got me beat," he smiled. "But wait, something you were saying about your research. I think..." He paused, and she looked at him expectantly. "I think I remember reading a diary of a doctor who'd been visiting that family, the Carrolls, around that time. This was a few months ago. Let me check. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back."
"Okay," Margaret said. "But only because I have to study, and this is where I always do that."
Margaret watched him retreat into the darkness of the stacks and smiled. His eagerness to please was hard to resist. She turned to the shelves and began her hunt for items from the estate of Maryland Delegate Benjamin Carroll, which had yet to be categorized and labeled. When she returned to the table roughly 45 minutes later, Charlie was back in his seat, reading an old journal, one, he explained, that was kept by a physician, Dr. Solomon McClintock, who had been called to the Carroll estate during the Maryland smallpox epidemic of 1750. He was there to infect the Carrolls, Charlie explained. Margaret took a seat and wondered what this had to do with her research, but soon she was swept up in his enthusiastic account of the doctor's discovery. "It was groundbreaking medicine at the time," said Charlie. "The concept of inoculation, infecting those who didn't have smallpox with a small dose of the disease. Cotton Mather popularized it after learning about it from..."
"Mather from the Salem witch trials?" Margaret interrupted.
Charlie nodded. "One and the same. Mather's slave taught him about the concept of inoculation, and then Mather shared it with the rest of the colonies. McClintock learned about it from Mather, and he was summoned to the Carroll estate to save them after a cousin contracted smallpox in Baltimore and returned to rural Maryland and infected them all."
"And you just happened to have been reading this a few months ago? Is this your field of study? Are you pre-med?"
"No, history. But this wasn't part of that either. I was doing a favor for my dad, actually, during that smallpox outbreak in Queens earlier this year. He was working with the mayor and the commissioner of health on a mass inoculation.
Oh, interesting, said Margaret. I lost money on a bet after the smallpox inoculation in April.
Because Bevins got sick? Charlie asked. The Yankee pitcher's inoculation had temporarily put him on the disabled list.
It threw off the whole rotation, Margaret said. When he returned to the mound against the Sox, he was shaky.
Great season, though, Charlie said.
Can't argue with the World Series.
Anyway, he asked me to look into the history of public sentiment and vaccinations, Charlie said. I took a couple detours down some rabbit holes, and one of them was Cotton Mather.
But what does that have to do with my ponies? She finally asked.
Charlie beamed with the satisfaction of someone about to deliver good news and raised a gloved finger. I'll show you. Using tweezers, he carefully opened McClintock's journal. He turned to Margaret. When were the ponies first mentioned?
The first reference to them anyone has been able to find was in 1752, she recalled, on Susquehannock Island, which is closest to the mainland.
Charlie nodded thoughtfully. I have a vague memory of McClintock mentioning an island. He turned the fragile journal pages. The doctor's messy script and the 18th century language made for slow going. Here it is, he finally said.
May I look?
Margaret asked. He glanced up and she smiled. Sure, of course. He stood, removed the white gloves, and handed them to her. She took his seat, put them on, and began delicately perusing the diary. Charlie lingered for a few seconds before he decided to resume his work at the next desk. The library was dead silent for several minutes until Margaret gasped.
I can't believe this, she said.
What? Said Charlie, rising and walking over to her. What?
So almost as an afterthought, the doctor writes of all these events that took place in the area before he arrived. One of them is a Spanish galleon that wrecked off the coast of Maryland earlier that year, after a hurricane, the wreck of La Galga.
The Greyhound.
Indeed. And look right here, she said, pointing at one passage. The doctor notes that La Galga was believed to have been carrying ponies, because after the storm, a number of them were seen on both the mainland and Susquehannock.
Let me see that. He leaned in.
Incredible. This is going to be huge news among the, at least 10 people who care, she said, but the excitement on her face was genuine.
By the way, a ship from that same fleet inspired Stevenson to write Treasure Island, Charlie added. Everything is connected. Margaret looked at him and grinned. The wind outside the library whistled, and the radiator clanked, and that was that. Chapter 7, Wednesday, January 20th, 1954, Nanticoke Island, Maryland. Margaret huddled in her coat as she lay on the damp grass, silently watching a string of 5 ponies wading into a marsh. The beasts bent their necks toward the saltwater cordgrass that grew thick on the west side of Nanticoke Island. The sun rising behind them began to brighten the silhouetted scene, the beach and water emerging like a pale blue and gray canvas behind the dark outlines of the animals. A ray of light landed on the forehead of one of the larger ponies, revealing a white teardrop-shaped spot. He repeatedly snorted and bared his teeth.
What's he doing?
Margaret whispered to Dr. Lewis Gwinnett, the head of the research team, who lay on his stomach next to her, binoculars in hand and a notepad by his side. He leaned in closer and put his mouth next to her ear.
Don't know, he whispered.
She raised an eyebrow at him and he smiled. The grazing ponies remained oblivious to their presence.
Notice how distended their stomachs are, Gwinnett whispered. They all look pregnant, even the 2 males.
Margaret blanched at his mention of pregnancy. She knew she didn't show yet, but she was concerned that news of her condition would prompt some paternalistic impulse on Gwinnett's part. Men seemed to treat pregnant women like invalids, she'd observed, and she had 7.5 months to go and a lot of work to do before this baby arrived. She was determined to make the most of her time while it was still her own.
Do you think that's because of all the cordgrass they eat?
Margaret asked, focusing on the matter at hand.
Its salt content is quite high, so they would have to drink more.
That's likely it, Gwinnett agreed. Margaret stole a look at him. With his shock of thick, prematurely white hair, deep-set sky-blue eyes, and a jawline so sharp it could cut wood,
he looked more an international captain of industry, or a New England governor, than a zoologist. Teardrop, as they'd decided to call him, casually sidled up to one of the mares and began sniffing her front legs, then proceeded down to her ribs, her rear legs, and her tail. The mare looked unbothered by this attention until, without warning, Teardrop pushed his head forward and bit the mare's rear end, prompting her to emit a guttural shriek. She backed quickly away and took refuge between the other two mares. The other stallion in the string, pitch black and slightly larger than Teardrop, snorted, whinnied, then reared onto his hind legs, briefly almost standing. Roaring, he landed angrily, stomping onto the sand a hair's distance from Teardrop, who backed up a few steps. The two stallions locked eyes. Teardrop had a decision to make. The three mares stood frozen in rapt attention. Margaret and Gwinnett lay still on the sand, similarly enthralled. If birds were chirping, Margaret couldn't hear them. Teardrop gave a snort, then quickly turned tail and trotted away from the other four ponies. As quickly as the conflict had started, it came to an unremarkable end. The remaining ponies in the string continued grazing on the cordgrass. Margaret exhaled. Adrenaline was coursing through her veins, pounding into her stomach. The raw confrontation, sex, violence, status, terrified and thrilled her. "That was intense," she finally said. "I could use a drink." Gwinnett looked at his watch. "It's 6:15 in the morning, Mags," he smiled. "And more important, my flask is back at the campsite." Half an hour later, after the ponies had galloped off, Margaret and Gwinnett walked back to their camp, where another researcher, a cheery blonde graduate student named Annabel Lane, was lighting a match from a small fire over which a pot of hot water was just starting to boil. The match blazed, and she lit her cigarette. Gwinnett ducked into his tent, and Lane continued to heat water for their coffee. "Tell me everything," Annabel said, and Margaret described how Teardrop had challenged the alpha in the string and been chased away. "So where does he go now?" "After the colts run off, they all tend to find one another, and then they form these roving bands of bachelor stallions." Annabel rolled her eyes. "Sounds like commons on a Saturday night." She opened a collapsible metal cup and shook in some instant coffee from a tin. She handed it to Margaret, then carefully poured hot water from the pot into the cup. "Hold on, I'll get you a spoon," Annabel said. "And some sugar, if you have it?" Gwinnett emerged from his tent with a small flask. With Margaret's assent, he poured a couple of sips of bourbon into her coffee. "How'd you sleep?" Annabel asked, handing Margaret a spoon and two sugar cubes. "Like a baby," Margaret said. "I woke up every hour and cried." Annabel and Gwinnett smiled indulgently. "You should get a vinyl airbed," Annabel suggested. Margaret settled herself on the ground next to Annabel. "When I was a kid, my mom and sister and I moved right near here on the mainland to stay with my uncle, and the three of us would sleep in a tent throughout the whole summer and into the fall. Slept soundly every night." Margaret recalled the comfort and security she'd felt in those moments, ensconced between her older sister and mother in two sleeping bags her mom had ripped apart and sewn together, a cocoon for the three of them. "Where was your father?" Gwinnett asked, taking a seat on a large rock. "You ever hear of the USS Shenandoah?" she asked. "Of course," Gwinnett said. "I'm Navy myself." He paused, clearly aware of what her question implied. "Horrible thing." "What was it?" Annabel said. "Dirigible crash in Ohio," Margaret said. "My dad was killed along with 13 other men." She hadn't spoken of her father's accident since the first time she told Charlie about it more than a decade before. She wasn't sure why she had just decided to break her long silence. Maybe being back on Nanticoke justified a moment to indulge that pain. She felt anew that sinking feeling in her chest, the fresh grief always there, no matter how skilled she'd become at ignoring it. "Oh, I'm so sorry," Annabel said, looking down into her coffee. "What Mags isn't saying is that her father was a true hero," Gwinnett said. "The military at the time was convinced rigid airships like the Shenandoah were the future of warfare because they could fly so high, and this was the Navy's first one. So it was akin to on-the-job training for its crew. Margaret's father and the other men were truly on the front lines." Margaret walked to the fire to pour herself another cup of coffee. "It was a real mess," she said. We found out later the commander had tinkered with the design. The Navy had ordered everyone to fly despite the bad weather. No one wanted to, but there was this mad race to come up with a vessel that would be the world's best. We weren't even in a war. Kind of like the way the U.S. is treating the atomic race today.